Well, hey, we are here for this week's culture segment, and I get to introduce you to a new friend of Boundless. His name is Tim McConnell. He's a pastor actually here in Colorado Springs. Tim, welcome.
Thank you. It's awesome to be on here with you.
Great to have you. He is the pastor of First Presbyterian Church here in Colorado Springs, which I had to kind of break it down beforehand that I go to a different Presbyterian church and there were tears and whatever, but we got beyond it.
We can be friends. So, we can be Presby friends.
We can kind of be friends, but, you know, we'll see. We'll see how we do. But the real reason, not just like our, you know, our church stories, the real reason I brought him here is he has a new book out. It is called Happy Church. Now, not Happy Clappy Church, just
no.
Happy Church.
No clappy.
Okay, no. Happy minus the clappy. Actually, Pursuing Radical Joy as the People of God. And, okay, I'm just going to be honest, first of all, that you don't really, you know, this is why I said not happy clappy, because you don't come across as like, hey, let's all be happy, and we are Christians, and let's just smile and shake hands with everyone. So
right.
Do you have a hard, like a weird time reconciling the title of the book to people's perception of, hey, you're not the weird happy pastor?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm actually a Presbyterian pastor, and we're famous for not being happy, right?
So, right.
I pursued this kind of academically. Like, I recognized a lot of pastors were drawing this huge disparity between happiness and joy and saying, you can pursue joy, but you should never pursue happiness because that's going to lead you down all the wrong tracks. But I had known that in all my studies and the church fathers constantly talked about pursuing happiness. Great philosophers talked about the deep need of human beings to find happiness. And that if we couldn't talk about happiness as a church, it felt like we were actually muddling our witness to the gospel, because we know that happiness is ultimately found in Jesus Christ. So if we present to the world that we are not people who know how to talk about happiness or to seek happiness, then non-believers who are desperately trying to find happiness, why would they be interested in listening to us?
Yeah. So it's interesting because you actually tell a little bit of your own story throughout this, and kind of the idea that you didn't write a book on, you know, being happy as a believer because it came so naturally to you or because it was something you experienced throughout your life. Tell us a little bit about growing up and even, sad to say, because we talk a lot about marriage prep and heading into marriage, even on your own honeymoon, maybe being not quite the epitome of manifestation of all of this. So
right.
Give us some of the early signs that maybe something needed to change.
So it is funny to be the guy who wrote Happy Church, because it's absolutely true. I'm not naturally happy. I'm kind of a melancholy guy, and came from childhood where my parents loved me dearly, dearly. They loved me, but it was a divorce home, and I spent a lot of time alone, and I kind of thought happiness was something for people who had perfect families, and their moms were waiting at the front door with a warm plate of cookies and all that sort of stuff, and that just wasn't me. That wasn't my life. And I came to know Christian joy as I met Christ through Young Life, and that's a joyful, joyful ministry. And I came to see how important that was to break down barriers and open people's hearts for the gospel. But it wasn't natural for me at all. I had to really cultivate joy. I had to commit to seeking happiness in a deeper way. I went on my honeymoon. I met my wife, and even before she knew Christ, she was a very happy, joyful, positive, optimistic person, and I was not. Even though I knew Christ, and she, you know, she was, when we met, she didn't know Christ yet, and I was like this dark, like melancholy guy, and she was really positive all the time. But she met Christ. We got married. We went off on our honeymoon, and we both took books out of our backpacks or our little bags and to read on our honeymoon. And you know what I had brought? I had brought Soren Kierkegaard, The Sickness Unto Death, to read on my honeymoon.
And I'm guessing you got confronted about
my dear
that.
Wife, right, this was her first challenge maybe. She leaned over and had to explain very firmly that I was not going to be reading The Sickness Unto Death on our honeymoon.
Okay.
It's hilarious how many people I tell that story and they don't see any problem with it.
Right.
Like, why not?
Yeah.
But she was able to wrench that out of my hands and just say, look, that's not where your head's going to be.
And I'm sure you picked up some beach read as an alternative, right? Like some chick lit, whatever.
Actually, I had a book from Pope John Paul that I was interested in.
Nice. Excellent.
But that one flew. But no, happiness is something that I've had to work on and cultivate.
Mm-hmm.
And
to that point, you actually say, you make the statement that it's time to get serious about happiness. What does that actually look like? Because, you know, as Christians, we're not supposed to just muster up good works or muster up feelings or be like, okay, I got to try harder. I got to do more. I've got to earn this. So how do we even start in recognizing where we need to shore up the expression of happiness?
Yeah. So it wasn't long ago that guys like C.S. Lewis would say, joy is the serious business of heaven. And he actually wrote a friend of his named Sheldon Van Auken, and he said, it is a Christian's duty to be as happy as he can. And we're totally not there at all. I mean, when I went into writing this book, I love the church so much, Lisa, and I want the church to thrive. And what I'm hoping is that churches will sort of embrace a joy reform, because if we just keep muddling through as churches, giving in to all the things that are darkening our, you know, churches feel like they're losing the culture. Some people feel like they're losing church itself because it's not what it used to look like when they were kids. But there's a lot of people that say that being dutiful or being sort of down-mouthed or serious all the time is actually the Christian walk, and it's a responsibility to be kind of sour. But, you know, if we don't get to where we can talk about happiness and joy in a meaningful way, we're just going to be presenting a false picture of who God is, because we're God's people. And he uses us to reveal his character to a world that doesn't know him at all. And so if all the world sees is miserable, down-faced people, they're going to get the assumption that God is a miserable and down-faced and angry God. So, hey, joy is the second fruit of the Spirit. The Psalms are full of phrases like, happy the people whose God is the Lord. Mm-hmm. Jesus said to his disciples, I told you these things, so that my joy would be in you and your joy would be complete. So to get serious about happiness is to accept that God in some way is invested in our joy, that it matters to him that we not only locate joy in belonging to him and in all his blessings, but that we learn how to talk about and express and cultivate that joy so that people around us can be blessed by it.
Mm-hmm. If you were to describe a couple Christians in your life that you think are rocking this out, what does that look like in their life? Because I think it's so hard for us to, you know, you think of like a 20-something who's just like, I'm just trying to like survive. I now have student loans. I don't even have a good job. I'm away from my parents, or my parents split up. I didn't even grow up with it. They can't even envision what this looks like. So you tell us from your experience, when you see a Christian that you know is rocking out happiness, what do they look like?
You know, here's the amazing thing. Like, you've got this sort of stereotype that older people are curmudgeon-y and grumpy and, you know, their body hurts and don't talk to me, my sciatica, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I actually find that when I get around people, builder generation, mm-hmm. They know how to pursue joy better than my generation. I'm Generation Xer, better than the generations coming up behind me.
Yeah. And just so people know, that's like your grandparents and great grandparents for our audience for the most part.
That's right. Yeah. Think about, And these are the folks who went through difficult economies, you know, I mean, not quite the depression, but times when there was austerity and warfare and they'll be more ready to express and really work at being joyful than some of us who have grown up in comfortable times with, you know, I grew up with the Nintendo and all that, you know, VCR tapes, that was my era. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but you could, you know, watch whatever you want, be entertained by whatever you want at any given time. A lot of options are open to you. I mean, who's really kicking it out of the court? You know, you think about like Bob Goff and stuff like that, but they're just ridiculous. They're just off on their own planet. You know?
Sometimes I think that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe if we all had balloons all the time.
Yeah.
It just depends.
Like if we just tied balloons to our ears. And, I actually tend to think of, like, there's a couple in my church. I won't name them because he hosts our AA groups every week because he's a graduate mm-hmm. of that program, and they've been through some hard mm-hmm. stuff in their lives. Mm-hmm. Been married for over 50 years, close to 55, and every time I see them, they're smiling. They're smiling. They may have just been through the worst medical thing, like stuff that I was like, what? What happened to you? That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You must be in so much pain. He'll come up and give me a big hug, big smile, pat me on the back. And, you know, I say, where do you get that from? Mm-hmm. Their joy comes from knowing the Lord. And they wouldn't want worldly happenstance, the events of life, to somehow interrupt their expression of joy for what Christ has done for them. Mm-hmm. So it's actually the opposite. Like people say, well, oh, you're happy because good things are happening to you. Mm-hmm. Happy comes from that happenstance, all the same word family. And so you're happy if things happen to be going well for you. Mm-hmm. This is actually the exact opposite. When we talk about godly happiness that's built on a foundation of joy, what you're talking about is being happy because of what God has done and what he's promised in your life in the face of what's happening in the world around you. Mm-hmm. Happiness becomes almost a protest where you're saying, I'm not going to allow the things in my life to weigh me down because Jesus loves me so much. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to be in the younger generation. I mean, it's actually hard to have all the options supposedly in front of you. And particularly for the millennial generation, they've got that same crisis where everyone is saying to them, you've been handed everything. And so you're supposed to be successful immediately and thrive. But at the very same time, they've been growing up in an economy that didn't have options open. Mm-hmm. So I watch them you're not able to find that opportunity, even when they decide what direction to go. It's very difficult. But to cultivate happiness and joy is based on what God has done for us, not on what we're just experiencing in the world.
Yeah.
And I guess, Lisa, that's what I'd say. I'm really big on intergenerationalism. Mm-hmm. So I would say, hey, you need to get somebody in your life who, like, survived being separated for the Korean War, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And sit down with them and talk about how they approach their emotional day.
Yeah. It's interesting because, and I've told our audience this before, but a while back I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. And at the time, because so few of my peers were going through that, I would go find oldsters who had that. And so they became kind of my buddies walking through this season of, you know, stuff that can, quite frankly, be very hard when you're like, I am 29 years old and, you know, it's sometimes hard for me to sit on the floor or get up from the floor or do X, Y, Z. And I'll talk to someone who's 80 and they're like, yeah, it is for me too. We found, like, you know, a little kinship in that. And so I think that is so great to find, you know, people from whether or not you're struggling with something in particular. And to that point, I actually want to make mention, you know, we talk a lot here on the show about mental illness and depression. And I do want to throw out for anyone that if you are bona fide going through a struggle now, or you're saying, I cannot for the life of me even understand what Tim is talking about. Mm-hmm. We actually have a team of counselors here at Focus on the Family that you can talk to. Just call 1-800, the letter A and the word family. And one of them would love to chat with you about your specific situation and then maybe get you some continuing help, even in the area in which you live. To that end, and because everyone at Boundless knows that I just love oldsters, I reference that. Can you tell a story that you tell in the book about someone who would be an unlikely person to be happy, but was actually the very epitome of it?
You know, for a year, I was pastor of a little church up in the mountains outside of Charlottesville, Virginia. I was just interim pastor, and I had to leave that church because I was in the Army Reserve, and our division was headed to Iraq, And there was a woman that I was supposed to visit, and I kept putting it off. Her name was Mrs. Geneva McDaniel, and that's how they would refer to her. They'd call her Mrs. Geneva McDaniel. It's not Geneva. It's not Miss McDaniel. It was, you know, so actually I was kind of scared of her, you know, mm-hmm. because people would say, no, Mrs. Geneva McDaniel put that chair there. That chair will not be moved, you know. So So I finally went, and I went to visit her in her apartment, where she stayed alone, and she let me in. It was kind of dark and warm. And she said, "Oh, you're the young pastor I've been waiting to meet." I felt like, oh, I felt terrible, you know, that I hadn't met her yet. And she said, "Come in, come in." And she said, "You probably think I'm alone here, but I'm not. I wake up every morning with Jesus. And when I wake up, the first thing I do is greet my Lord, and I open the scriptures, and I pray. And then we walk together through the day, me and Jesus. We eat together. At the end of the day, I sing a little, and I pray, and I say goodnight to him." And she said, "And I can't tell you the treasures that the Lord has shown me in the quietness of this chamber with him." And I knew all of a sudden that I was in the presence of great wisdom. I couldn't believe that I had put off, I'd missed the opportunity to know her better. And I started unloading on her. I was like, "Oh my gosh, there's so much going on in my life. I mean, I have to leave this church, and I have to stop my PhD program, and I have to leave my wife and kids." And which, by the way, I never wound up going to Iraq. I went to Richmond and Indiana. That's another story. But we were separated. And but I said, when I was a younger man, it was so easy for me to say to the Lord, "You just take my life, whatever you want to use it for, Lord, I'll die for you." And I told her, "But right now, my wife depends on me. My kids depend on me. We have dreams. It's a lot harder for me to say, 'Jesus, if you want to take my life, here it is.'" And I told her, "It's been hard for me to pray." And she leaned over and she put her hand on my knee and she said, "Tim, I believe God has a purpose in everything. There's a reason why you were here with us in our church for a short time. And if he takes you to Iraq, there's a reason why he has you there. You can trust him. He's good."
And she would know.
And I cried.
I'm even crying now.
But to touch that kind of wisdom, and to know, to meet with someone who was truly dwelling in the habitual, in the ecstasy of the habitual presence of the Lord. I mean, she just was in the joy of the constant presence of Jesus. I knew that I needed a little bit more of that in my life.
Yeah. Well, and what's so crazy is it's so counterintuitive to what we think. We think we need Jesus plus a bunch of stuff, or we're going to tack on a little Jesus. And she's evidence that Jesus literally was enough, more than enough. And that's a cool lesson for all of us to remember.
Right. One of the things that really pushed me in the book is spending a lot of time in Kenya. And you know, why is it that you meet people who, by every measure that we currently in America are living to measure our happiness, they have nothing to put on that scale? Mm-hmm. Like, they have no, you know, real easy options for their future. They have none of the gilded stuff that we all have all around us to bring us comfort. And yet they're so happy in the Lord. I mean, they're just, they're, you can't deny the joy that they feel. And it's all hanging on Jesus and what he has done for them. Mm-hmm. And I met the same thing in Cairo when we were worshiping with people, and I would kind of pull people aside that were friends and say, "Aren't you kind of scared to worship? I mean, a bomb went off in Cairo just a month ago." And they would say, "I would not give up worship no matter what." Hmm. And they had a big smile on their face. My life belongs to Jesus. It's in his hands. Mm-hmm. How is it that people who are in danger, who have very little means, who are in places of real austerity and lack, how is it that they can pursue happiness so joyfully, so openly? And somehow in America, we think that our duty is to leave happiness behind, or that happiness is some kind of a dirty word. Mm-hmm. We've got to learn something from them.
Yeah. Or, and I'm going to meddle here, you know, like you said, I wouldn't give up worship for anything. And here we are, those of us, let's say, here in Colorado, who are like, "I don't know if I want to go to worship today. Maybe I'll just go mountain biking, or maybe I'll just sleep in or whatever." And right. We probably have something to learn on that front, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, worship is 1,000 cures. Mm-hmm. And to put God first in your life means putting God first on your calendar and saying, I'm going to give this hour to the Lord. I'm not going to come in and just measure what it does for me as a consumer. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to be a participant. I am going to worship the Lord and I'm going to give this hour to God. That's 1,000 cures. That's it cures you of pride. It cures you of self-centeredness, egotism. It cures you of all kinds of idolatries, because just in that time, in that community, as a body, you're putting Christ first. You're putting God in first place.
Yeah.
And everything else starts to fall into a different priority set.
What then is, like, when we think, I mean, there are some people that are just, they're just not happy because they've trained themselves to not be happy. Like you were talking about the curmudgeonly types, or people that are just, they have just allowed themselves to slip into negativity that they can't seem to climb out of. So what is our responsibility as Christians for both and managing our circumstances for happiness versus managing our attitudes? When we take out all the bona fide conditions and everything and just, and the fact that you're going to have some down days. I mean, that's just going to be true. But sometimes we can change our circumstances, but sometimes we need to just change the perception of it. What's the difference and how do we do that?
So I'm really happy that you said what you said, because anytime we're talking about emotional balance, we need to be, I want to encourage people to get whatever help they can get to bring wisdom into their lives, to bring medical help, professional help into their lives if they're having that kind of a serious challenge. And don't even measure it that way. I mean, just go get help. Just talk to somebody. And but there is also a general Christian, you know, kind of, I think, responsibility to reflect what God has done in our lives in the right way. Eugene Peterson once said, "It's more easy for me to act my way into a feeling than to feel my way into an acting." So what he means is, there's some things that I can do that will actually change my feelings. Like, we're not actually totally subject to being tugged around by our emotional state. You can do some things. Really, where I'm trying to get, Lisa, is the book itself and my work is not as much about emotional balance. It's about our relationship with the church. And in coming into the church, everybody's got some kind of relationship with the church, good, bad, or indifferent. And what I'm trying to do is help people to feel more confident and feel joyful about their relationship with the church. And so there's a lot that we can do in the church to create a culture of happiness, to cultivate a community of happiness and joy. And that's where the leadership of the church and all of us who participate in the church and are trying to push the church forward, we've got a responsibility to cultivate a kind of a joyful body.
And I think it's so true that we, I mean, I think having been in the church for so long, we take it for granted in the sense that there is so much community, there is so much support there, there is so much opportunity for connection. And we just assume, I mean, I remember my friend telling me that a coworker of hers came up to her one day, and it was in the context of like dating, but I mean, this guy did not know the Lord, but he was trying to find just a good quality woman to date and then marry. And he's like, where do I even go? I mean, for him, the concept was so foreign. Like, he's like, if I don't go to a bar, where do I go?
Right.
And just how the world does not have natural avenues of connection and belonging and opportunity that we do. And so I think starting in that spot and realizing I can just show up, walk through the door of my church and see what God has for me there. And out of that, you know, see where that leads.
Yeah. Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Cost of Discipleship. That's a great book from a he just talked about, hey, you can't make your own salvation, you can't make your own conversion, but you do have this choice. You can go to church. You can hear the sermon. And he goes as far as to say, if you don't go to church, you are excluding yourself from the place where faith is a possibility. And it's true of a community, too. You know, one of the stories I tell in the book is of a friend of mine whose sister was going through a really difficult time with her marriage, and she got off the phone after a long conversation with her sister, and she immediately group texted her prayer partners. And she, you know, told them, oh, pray for my sister. And she hit send. As soon as she hit send, she had this like sick feeling inside that maybe I've just breached confidence with my sister. Hmm. You know, maybe she didn't want anybody to know about this. So she called her sister back and said, this is what happened. I texted my prayer group really fast. I wasn't even thinking, but they will keep confidence. They're good at keeping confidence. And I'm sorry. Well, her sister got really quiet and she wasn't mad. But what she said was, you mean you have people who pray for those kinds of things hmm. in your life? Hmm. You know, people are so alone. They're so isolated, you know, and we take it for granted that we in church have people who are going to care for us, who are going to walk with us through suffering, hmm. who are going to go to the Lord for us in prayer.
Yeah. And what's it to that point, Tim, what would be your recommendation, you know, and this is for more than just church leaders. This is not the job of the pastor. This is not, but for us to lead in happiness, to infuse that into other people. Like, what are some good examples of that, short of, you know, making a spreadsheet of all the melancholy people in our life and being like, I got to put extra time into them, you know, whatever. and just make the pinpoint them as the big downers. Yeah. What's a great way for us to just truly shore up other people who may not know how to help themselves?
Okay, that's great. Yeah. I mean, my main point with the book about pursuing radical joy together as a people of God is I kind of want you to go to church differently. Like, I want you to come to church and see this array of gifts that God has given his people, the community of God, in order to make them a kind of a people that is reflecting his character, his loving character. And so I want you to come and feed on the Word of God differently. I want you to recognize that feeding on the Word of God is this huge gift. It's this huge gift from God. I want you to sing differently. I want you to actually think about how important it is that we sing together as a body of Christ. And that even if you've got, you know, no talent, just make a noise, you know, because singing together is something that Christians have done from the catacombs. I mean, they heard them singing out of the catacombs, like, what's going on? And it's something that we've always done as a body together, and it's a gift. The way that we come to the table together, even not just communion, Lord's Supper, or Eucharist, whatever your church calls it, but just when we come together to eat, you know, every time we come together as a body of Christ to eat, we're enacting this coming kingdom, this coming table where we're all going to be included and we're all going to be lovingly joined with one another around a common feast. And I just want people to see all these gifts and to just delight in them, because these are the common things that every church has. You know, we don't all go to mega churches. Most people go to small churches where we're just trying to stitch it together, keep it running. And but every church, large or small, has the same taproot of joy. Joy in union with Christ. It's a joy that's based on what God has done to unite us to himself in Jesus Christ. And if the churches across America will tap into that joy and learn how to cultivate it, there's going to be a revival. I mean, you know, and that joy is the same for a church of any size. Mm-hmm. There's an old church father, I can't remember which one, who said, honey tastes the same on the lips of a king and a pauper. That's what joy is. Mm-hmm. It tastes the same. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if you're at a mega church or at a small church, small country church. It doesn't matter if you're a king or if you're poor. God has given us this gift, second fruit of the Spirit, joy. Mm-hmm. And it tastes the same.
So true. All right. Well, this has been awesome. Folks, the book is Happy Church, Pursuing Radical Joy as the People of God. We've been talking to Tim McConnell. He is a pastor and, like I said, you know, very much passionate about having the church reflect the joy and the happiness of God and how we can do that when we truly put that stake in him alone and then the outward working of that. We get to it a lot faster as a result of that. So thank you so much for being part of this.
This is really fun. And thanks for having me. And I just, you got an awesome audience and following, and just so grateful for what you're doing.